Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thank you, Marshall. New original musicals are always ambitious undertakings, and it's always fascinating to learn about how they get conceived and developed. Williamstown Theater Festival has a brand new, completely original musical having its world premiere this summer called Limpika, about the Russian-born artist best known for her portraits in the Art Deco style. There's no one better than my guest today to tell us what Limpika's story is about and how a musical based on her has come about. And that is Carson Kreitzer, who wrote the book and lyrics, and Matt Gould, who composed the music for this new musical opening July 19th at Williamstown. Welcome, Carson. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, Dan.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for both being on the line from Williamstown now. I presume you're taking some time out of rehearsals, and I really appreciate that.
We're not taking any time out. The whole cast is sitting here watching this all happen before them.
You're kidding. They must have something better to do. But anyway, let's get to the meat of the story. That it would be this story. So Carson, it's rare to get both the composer and the lyricist and the playwright at the same time. So Carson, let's start with you. For those who don't know anything about the art world, tell us who this woman is and why she's the subject of this new musical.
Sure. Tamara de Limpika is an incredible woman, a wonderful artist, but the reason for looking at her story has a lot to do with her grit, her drive, and her sheer energy to survive in the face of incredible odds. This is a woman whose life intersected with the great upheavals of the 20th century. She was a young bride at the time of the Russian Revolution and had to flee a life of wealth and privilege and landed in Paris with her aristocratic husband, having lost everything, with only the jewels she could stuff in her handbag. And she had to reinvent herself and figure out how to survive, how to support her family, and became an artist at this amazing time in Paris when all these different movements were coalescing and people from all over Europe were gathered in Paris, trading ideas and inspiring each other. And in that time, she falls in love with one of her models, who's a prostitute named Rafaela. And the story of this woman torn between two great loves and trying to be the best artist that she can be in the world is really the subject of the musical. And we have the kind of drumbeat of the rise of fascism happening in the background that is the threat to all of their lives and everything that is happening.
She had a very long life, born in 1898 and died in 1980. So which period of time does the musical focus on?
We're really looking at the sort of the central nugget of her life as an artist, which is really that time between the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and World War I and World War II.
Great.
So Paris between the wars. The main focus.
So both Matt and Carson, how did you both become interested in this topic or this personality or this piece of history as the source of a musical?
Well, Carson, we met maybe 8 or so years ago, and she and I had worked together casually on something, and she showed me this art book of this artist, Tamara de Limpika, who I didn't know, though I had recognized her work in the book. And Carson often writes plays about what she describes as difficult women. I wouldn't say difficult because somebody would come for me. But Carson, you should say what you mean by difficult women. What are difficult women?
I do, as a playwright, I have a fascination with women who do not behave, women who refuse to just be what society asks of them. I think women are often asked to be smaller than they could be, asked to be essentially supporting characters. And I love women who choose to be the protagonist, and I think we need more of them. And girls growing up need to hear stories of women who take center stage in their own life.
So when did you first learn of Limpinka?
You know, a friend of mine told me about her. This is actually someone I've worked with a few times, and he said, "You have got to check out Tamara de Limpinka. She is one of your women. You are going to love her."
Okay,
and
so
sure enough.
So that's what attracted to you as an author, as a playwright, about this personality. Mm-hmm. Now, let's get back to Matt. What attracted you about the prospects of this life as being something you could musicalize and compose over?
Well, her paintings really make music themselves. I think, you know, a lot of folks want to write musicals these days. It's a thing that I think a lot of writers are trying to get into, and so people talk to me a lot about, like, oh, let's write a musical about this. Let's adapt that movie, this book, that thing. And oftentimes it just doesn't really speak to me. And I looked at these paintings and just heard music immediately. And didn't know anything about her life and didn't know anything about exactly the time in which she was living and where she was painting. And it was like a visceral thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this is like Lady Gaga. This is Madonna. This is before I even realized that Madonna collects Limpinka.
Mm-hmm.
That there are a lot of you know, just pop culture icons in our time who collect Limpinka's work, because there is something about it that captures a certain Hollywood glamour, that captures a certain grandness, a certain bigness. And I'll also say this, as Carson taught me more about Limpinka, and then as I began to learn more about who she was and what she did, I felt like it wasn't only little girls who need to learn stories about women who don't take back the back seat but take center stage, but also little boys need to hear those stories too, because if we want to change our culture, you know, all of our children have to learn that women can be at the center of the story. And that felt like a really exciting story to tell.
Great. In case you're just joining us, my guests are Carson Kreitzer, who wrote the book and the lyrics for a brand new world premiere musical called Limpinka that's going to start at Williamstown Theater Festival on July 19th, and she's joined by her collaborator, Matt Gould, who did the music. Let's talk a little bit about how you guys work. Okay, so Carson, you've written the book, you've changed it here, changed it there. Do you go to Matt and say, I've got this great scene, this is where I really need a song to move the book from A to Z in this scene? Or Matt, do you look at the script and say, wait a minute, I've got this melody in my head and I want to put it in here. I think this is a good place for it. How does this all come together?
Sorry, you just got a little laugh from me on you've written the book past tense, because
you're still
I was just coming out of a rehearsal where I was just rewriting a scene and we all had pencils and I added three lines back and then took something else out.
Well, that was part of my later questions, because I was going to ask if you were, I was going to ask later if you are rewriting as you're rehearsing, which clearly you are. So
oh, yes.
There you are. Okay.
But Matt and I have really built this thing up from the ground in a very organic way together. And we started talking about her life and what arc of her life we were going to deal with, because as you pointed out, she had a tremendously long and fascinating life, and we could dramatize so many parts of it. But we made basic decisions, and we started sort of index carding out what is the thrust of the musical, the way we are telling this life in song. And yet I am generally a playwright. I love these women who are difficult, but it is Limpinka's work and the bigness of the emotions here that make it feel like a musical rather than a play. This just never felt like it could live as a play.
So is the musical sung through? Is it songs that are knitted together with a lot of interstitial music? What have you worked up, Matt?
I mean, like Carson said, that's been a really organic process. I think In the beginning, I think that we had envisioned that there would be big scenes that would connect songs together. I think there was a stretch of time over the last several years where it started to become much more sung through, where it was maybe like almost 90% sung through. And as we've really started to get into the refining stages, we've realized, oh, we need to actually hear more detail through scene. There's certain information that's hard to land in song alone in this particular story. And I think every story is its own beast. You know, some stories you can sing. You can sing Les Mis. It's like, you know, I dreamed a dream and we got it. I think in this story, in the way that we're telling it, there were certain details that wanted to come out in scene rather than song. And so I think it's a lot sung, and there are some really substantial scenes that help move us from piece to piece.
So as a composer, let me ask you this. Do you think the purpose of song in the modern musical is to advance plot, to get the character from A to Z, or to set mood and just create the mise-en-scene, or is it all the above?
All of that. Yeah. Yes, all of that. And I would also say that Carson, and I say this with deep respect, Carson has a very heady way of writing, and I have a very emotional way of composing, which are two aspects that could really butt up against each other. And sometimes, you know, we get into it, like, lovingly, and we go, no, this has to be more emotional. We're not landing this idea of what fascism, what futurism is. And those two things, I think that we've really managed to develop a really beautiful synthesis between the heady and the heart, which has allowed us to do all those things that you're saying through the music, to advance the plot, to deepen the characters, and hopefully to cut a hole, to open a hole in the hearts of the audience so that people can feel something and walk out changed.
Good. This is not a funny thing to ask about, but it's a hard thing, I think, to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What kind of I don't want to say what kind of a song, but I want to say what kind of music, because if you're dealing with that period between the wars and just before, are you trying to evoke the period, the music of the period, the continental music of the period? Are you borrowing from the jazz idiom that filtered to the Europe at the time? Or are you sprinkling in some of it, what people might strike to their ear as nice Broadway melody? What kind of style do you write in?
Yes, what to is, all that as
yeah,
well.
Okay.
You know, I'm
hearing some giggling in the background there.
That's
yeah.
Me.
Well, I mean, I think Lempicka, as a painter, she borrowed from many different places. She was inspired by many different kinds of classical painting and futurism and Picasso and all cubism, all of these sort of different kind of aspects. And I think that because of who she was in her time, which was that she really was a pop culture icon in her day. Like, people thought this lady and the work that she did was groundbreaking and amazing. And I, you know, I compare a lot of times. I was like, this is Beyonce in Paris in the 1930s. This is what she was doing in the art world. And so we wanted to create. For me, it was about creating, like, well, how do we take that idea and translate it to 2018? And so I think the music is definitely pop inspired, but it absolutely harkens back to the jazz age. Absolutely harkens back to those periods and borrows from those periods, so that it feels like something that you know, a contemporary audience is like, oh, this feels really familiar to me, but also evocative of a time. And that was a goal that we had.
Well, speaking of which, go ahead, Carson.
I should say, yeah, because we're not telling something, we're not telling a historical story for the sake of this is a fascinating moment in history. We're telling this woman's story because of what she means to us now.
Right.
And what this story means to us now. And the emotions are very, very contemporary and current, and things that we want the audience to be in the middle of, not at a comfortable remove.
Right.
We're not just watching a story of history. We're watching
the story of now,
what is happening right now.
Right. But given the kind of layered history and the kind of layered personality that you're dealing with in the context, I do want to ask you to comment on the director that you have, Rachel Chavkin, who, for those of us who are familiar with theater, directed Natasha and the Great Comet of 1812. And already in hearing you describe Limpinka, I'm thinking, wow, what a perfect match for a director and your story. Can you talk about that?
It's been so thrilling to watch our story come to life in three dimensions, finally, and we have been working on this and hearing it in reading after reading in this sort of concert version with actors at music stands, and to see it live and breathe and, I want to say, swarm. I mean, what Rachel is doing is really incredible, and I kept expecting to take this musical to a director and hear, like, this is impossible. You know this is impossible. You know we can't change clothes that quickly. This isn't going to happen. And Rachel just is making it all happen. And it's thrilling. And it's very kinetic, and it's very alive.
Okay, so you mentioned a kinetic production about an artist. Now, here's the trap, and Carson, you can talk about this. Artists live internalized kind of lives, which give an expression on a canvas or on a stage. So how do you dramatize something that is an internal phenomenon that comes from the principle that you're trying to dramatize?
I think that's one of the things that song is really perfect for, is that moment where the world stops and cracks open and you get the internal life of a character. And that's really why it didn't feel like a play. Mm-hmm. It felt like we need that different storytelling. We need that different stage time, mm-hmm. and the way a thought evolves. We can get that kind of privacy with a character mm-hmm. in the midst of also this delicious chaos of the world and Paris, and then suddenly the world stops. There's one moment in Act Two where we get a particular portrait being painted that just operates in a completely different time and space than you could ever get in a play. And that's, I mean, many, many moments are the most thrilling for me, and working with Matt has been the greatest joy of my life as an artist.
In case you're just joining us,
create these moments.
We're talking about Limpinka. You're just hearing from Carson Kreitzer, who wrote the book and the lyrics, and she's on the line with her collaborator, Matt Gold, who did the music. The show, obviously, is off script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. So, Matt, tell us about, you talked about borrowing from a lot of different disciplines, I guess, in composing the music. How is it going to sound? Do you depend a lot on strings? Is it harpsichordy? Is it jazzy? What should we expect?
Yeah, well, we have a 10-piece orchestra. Mm-hmm. We have a string section, we have a brass section, and then we have a heavy electronic section too. Again, I think in Limpinka's time, she came of age at a time when machines, industry, technology were really on the rise, and that is a theme that plays heavily in our show. And so it was always important that orchestrationally, that there be a somewhat of a tug of war between the organic sounds of the string mm-hmm. and the brass and mm-hmm. the piano, and then the very polished sound of the machine, of the computer, as it were. And so it is a synthesis of those two things. The kinds of things that we hear on the radio today, which are these very polished, perfectly engineered tracks, and then a very organic, orchestral, traditional sound.
Mm-hmm. The actresses. Let's talk about them for a minute. I was doing some research for the program, and I realized that Eden Espinosa and Carmen Cusack, I guess Carmen plays your title character, right?
Eden plays Tamara de Limpinka. Carmen plays her lover, Rafaela.
Okay. Yeah. But they both played at some point Elphaba in Wicked.
We actually have three Elphabas.
You're kidding.
There's another actress in our cast also. Yes, we are the Elphaba crew, and they're amazing. And I think it actually says something As we were casting this, one of the things I would always say is, like, if they haven't played Elphaba, they're not going to be able to sing this score.
Okay.
It really is, it's an extraordinarily vocally demanding score on these women. And I think that one of the goals we had was to create a piece that could showcase and highlight all of the female voice, that we could show all of it in all of its glories, in all of its intricacies. And so these women are singing for the gods. It is just epic. And our two leads, Carmen and Eden, are just not only extraordinary singers, they're extraordinary actresses and extraordinary humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's something that's rare in musical theater to find actors who are not only wonderful singers, but just brilliant, beautiful actresses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're going to really move audiences. It's just astounding what they're doing.
Carson, going back, way back when you had this story kicking around in your head, and then you sit there in rehearsals and you watch these two actresses sing these parts, is that what you had in mind, or is it better, or is it different?
Yeah, Carson, is that what you had in mind?
it's always better to be and to see it. I just keep saying living and breathing. You know, it's very different, and a thrill. But I said before that, you know, Matt and I had really created the piece very organically together, and that holds true of every single song.
Mm-hmm.
And we build them together. So it's not like I write the words, I hand it to Matt, he makes it music. We are kicking it back and forth. I write a whole bunch of words and ideas and thoughts, and Matt sits at the piano and starts playing things and says, you know, this feels like a chorus. And I said, wait a minute, but what about this? And this is the bridge. Give me two more of these for the verse. And so it's a thing that feels organic in the music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always been a sort of poetic writer as a playwright, and I need to hide that. I need to kind of make it subtle and have it under the radar. Mm-hmm. And I'm always telling actors, like, don't play the poetry, just kind of make it feel natural. And to be able to work with Matt and have the poetry feel right. That it's song
right.
is so glorious.
You mentioned
actually a couple of the actors when we started the first week, a couple of the actors asked me, like, did you do the lyrics? Did Matt do the lyrics? And I said, no, I did the lyrics. And they both said, oh, it sounded like it was one person who wrote the song. And that is my favorite thing I've ever heard.
Speaking of chorus, and not as chorus as in a song, but chorus as an ensemble, is this a large cast or a smallish cast as in, let's say, Passion? Just a couple of principal characters.
Well, it definitely revolves around a few principals, but there are 15 people on the stage, and it feels like there are 30.
Right.
So, I mean, look, by new musical standards, 15 is really big.
It's huge. It's huge.
And
yeah.
I think it speaks a lot to just the support and belief in Williamstown. It is impossible, I mean, literally impossible, to get new musicals produced. And the fact that Williamstown said, not only are we going to produce your musical, we're going to do it with a cast of 15 and a 10-person orchestra, and, you know, just tons of behind-the-scenes people making this. It's epic. It really is epic.
Where did Williamstown first see this? You did this in a workshop kind of presentation up on, is it Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket? Where was it? Or no?
We've done a couple readings in New York.
Mm-hmm.
We worked for a while over at Yale Rep on this, at Virginia Rep. We've kind of hopped around. And I say this hopefully not sounding too shady, but Williamstown saw it at the NAMT Festival in New York City, which is a festival of new musicals. And Williamstown was and Mandy Greenfield was
right.
the one who said, I want to do it. I'm tired of hearing this being read. I want to do it. And I think that that's something that, you know, new writers need. They need somebody to say, like, I'm going to do the work. And she did. And so we're here.
One final question. Working with Rachel Chavkin is a choreographer who did a show in New York called Death of a Black Man in the Whole Entire World. Now, I saw this play the day after the 2016 election, so my head was upside down. But one thing I remember about it is that the stage movement that this guy created was really remarkable. Can you tell us something about the stage movement and choreography that's unique about this production?
Yes, our choreographer is Raja Feather-Kelly. He is a brilliant choreographer from New York City. And I think it was always in our minds that that this piece was going to need to move in a very, Carson used the word kinetic, kinetic way, but also in a very specific way that felt specific to Lempicka's time, to her paintings. And Raja is really finding just a beautiful way of gestural language.
Well, I think, and it sounds like you found a beautiful way to put this all together. Unfortunately, we're going to have to conclude the program. So all I can do now is to thank you and to say I'm really looking forward to seeing Lempicka at Williamstown Theater starting July 19th. Carson and
Wonderful.
Matt, thank you very much for joining us on Off Script.
Thank you.
See you
there.
Okay. Break a leg.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us. The program's been Off Script. Again, my guests have been Carson Kreitzer, lyricist and book writer of Lempicka and her collaborator who did the music, Matt Gould, starting Williamstown Theater Festival July 19th. Until the next time you join us on Off Script, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.